From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is Which Way LA.
California's agricultural miracle. How long can it last? Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. California's 450-mile-long Central Valley produces one-third of all the food grown in the U.S. It's a precious resource often forgotten by those of us in the rest of the state. New York Times food columnist and cookbook author Mark Bittman has paid a recent visit and found that the astounding production levels of the past 100 years may not be sustainable. We'll hear what's being done to destroy and to save the Central Valley. Also tonight, with campaign commercials filling the air, we'll take another look at Proposition 32 on political contributions by payroll deduction. What does it do? Who's in favor? Who's opposed? Later on, abortion rights, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the race for the White House. First, here's the news. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. on KCRW. Vice President Biden and Congressman Ryan disagreed last week on questions central to controversy about women's rights. We'll hear how abortion and the right to appoint Supreme Court justices have become issues in the presidential campaign. That's later on our program. First, this story. For yesterday's annual food edition, Mark Bittman, author of many cookbooks and the leading food writer for the New York Times Magazine, asked his readers what he should do. All they wanted, he found, was something on big farming, small farming, sustainability, politics, poverty, and, of course, truly delicious food. Well, he found it all in the same place. California's Central Valley, running 450 miles from Bakersfield up to Redding between the Sierra Nevada mountains and the Coast Ranges. It's larger than nine states put together, where the climate allows for four growing seasons, and it's the largest patch of Class I soil in the world. It produces some 230 crops. It's a precious natural resource, but he found it's in trouble. Mark Bittman, welcome to Which Way LA.
Hey, Warren, nice to talk to you again.
I have to tell our listeners we won't be giving out any food recipes today. I'm sorry for that, but we will talk a lot about the Central Valley. You started out with 6 million pounds of carrots a day produced by the Bolthouse Farms. What's good about that? What's bad about it?
They're not even the biggest producer, as it turns out. But, you know, I left L.A. assuming that I was going to have my mind blown that day, and it took about 10 minutes after I got to Bakersfield for that to happen. It's just incredible when you see food in a kind of quantity that turns it into art, but almost like installation art, not great art. What's good about it is, you know, there are carrots for everybody and they're affordable. What's bad about it is that they're, for the most part, they're produced as a commodity with, I won't say no, but little care for their flavor and for their impact on the soil and air around them.
So they're not an example of truly delicious food.
They are not an example of truly. Look, I can make those carrots taste good, and if you want to get into recipes, we can do that. But
you're the man who can.
They are
it.
Not the best carrots you ever. Mm-hmm. They're the carrots you buy in cellophane at the supermarket for 99 cents a pound.
One of the things that you talk about is generations of people who have become very wealthy at the same time that generations of other people, especially farm workers, are living in the dust. How does that lead you to the kinds of conclusions you drew about the future of the Valley?
Well, it's a tough place. I mean, it really is a tough place because you can't deny that this kind of bounty is a desirable thing. We want 99-cent carrots, and there's an efficiency of the scale, and there's an efficiency of the way things have been done there, the way they've evolved, that is undeniably, there are good things about it. It's not entirely good. It's not entirely bad either, but a lot of it is based on the work of people who were working for minimum wage or less. And, there's an increasing amount of attention paid to so-called sustainability in this country and to how animals are treated and how the land is treated, but a lot of people ignore how labor is treated. And probably the dirtiest secret of the Central Valley is that there are hundreds of thousands of immigrants working for minimum wage or sub-minimum wage. And, you know, three of the country's five poorest cities are in the Central Valley, and that's because those people are immigrant farm workers.
You also saw something new, though, minority farmers on small plots of land. How does that represent changes in the Central Valley?
I don't know whether that's new or not, Warren, to tell you the truth. But it was unexpected, for sure. And what I saw was a Hmong farmer, a woman, late 50s, working for 4 acres in the outskirts of Fresno, who, you know, worked 50, 60 hours a week on the land, and then another 10 or 20 hours a week doing her accounts, selling her goods, and delivering her goods. I don't know that she was happy, but she seemed quite content with that life because, as she said, she had freedom. She was outside. She was working for herself. And again, there are thousands, if not tens of thousands, of people living that kind of life, farming 4, 6, 8, 10 acres in the Central Valley on a very small scale for sustenance, you know, for really supplying their families with food. And that's a pretty amazing story. I mean, the soil is as good for small farming as it is for big farming, which I'm sure Tom Willey can talk about.
We're going to talk with him in a moment. I think, as someone who's reported a little bit on the Central Valley over the years, I think what's new about that is the number of different minorities, including the Hmong, who have appeared in recent years, and also the fact that I think some of that land that's available was at one time set for development, and then the housing boom came through. It didn't get developed, and so it's available cheap. I think that's new as well.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, you know, the pressure from development on farmland in the Central Valley was really, really great. That's been reduced to some extent. But, there are a lot of conflicts going on there. It is a land of 1,000 conflicts. It's amazing.
Well, but let you introduce Tom Willey rather than me. Why did you talk to Tom Willey?
Tom, there was no one I asked about the Central Valley who knew anything, who didn't say, go meet Tom and Dinesh Willey. And Tom is, a hard-headed, pragmatic, but also idealistic organic farmer doing a beautiful job on 75 acres in Madera, just north of northwest of Fresno. And, you know, he can tell you more about it, obviously.
And before I get to him, he's got 75 acres. How many acres does Bold House Farms have for all those carrots?
I think the number was 10,000, actually.
Okay, so we're talking...
I'm sorry. The number was 30,000, 15,000 of which were in production at any given time.
Okay, so we're talking enormous differences in scale.
Yeah. But 75 acres, for those of us who are not farmers, is a very impressive plot of land.
Looks like a lot of land to me. Tom Willey, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
Farmer owner of T&D Willey Farms in Madera, California. That's about halfway up
the valley. Very provocative piece you wrote, Mark.
Tom.
Okay, obviously this is the first time you've talked since the piece appeared. Tom, tell us about sustainable farming, organic farming. What are the differences?
Well, we don't know what sustainable farming is. Organic farming is very well defined. It's a set of laws that we follow to produce food that we can put the certified organic label on. Those laws are now in the hands of the USDA. Sustainable farming is a big topic that is trying to grapple with whether we can keep the productive abundance of agriculture going on indefinitely into the future. And so that's very undefined.
Well, now, one thing you do differently on your 75 acres than Bold House does on its 30,000 is to grow 40 different varieties of vegetables.
Yes, it's very much a polyculture where Bold House is sponsoring, you know, at least 30,000 acres of monoculture carrots. I've heard even 50 or 60,000. Huge numbers. So our farm is very unique. It's so unique in its patchwork quilt of many different crops that people driving through the neighborhood many years back, one of them actually gawking so much drove off the road and ran into a telephone pole in front of the farm. So it sticks out.
What's good about it? Why do you do that rather than participate in one of these giant agribusinesses?
Well, I was actually trained in conventional farming and did work for agribusiness companies, sort of like Bolthouse, for a number of years, but we eventually adopted the organic approach. The reason is that if you want to farm without toxics and if you want to farm with natural fertility systems, you really have to bring in the diversity of nature into your farm. The more diverse you make it, the more stable it is, the more able you are to defend yourself. Your plants are able to defend themselves against pests and disease because you're creating a more complex ecology on the farm than is sponsored by a vast monoculture. So for the success of organic farming, you have to bring a lot of diversity into your system.
You say, though, that nobody really knows what sustainability is and that organic just means that you get a label devised by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. What don't you necessarily get if it says organic?
What don't you get?
Yeah.
If it says organic?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not really sure.
Maybe I should go back to Mark Bittman for that, because one of the things you pointed out, Mark, about that was you don't get labor laws and you don't get necessarily any requirement that there be attention paid to the quality of the soil and what you're doing to it.
Well, you get a requirement that the soil – you don't get labor laws for sure. And as Tom says, sustainability is also something you may or may not get. You know, organic, as he's pointed out, is a legal definition, whereas sustainable and fair, these are things that we're still discussing what they mean and how we can get there.
So, Tom Willey, what role do your farms and those like them play, or does your farm and those like it play in the evolution of agriculture in the Central Valley?
Well, I think that the organic movement is providing some baby steps in the direction of sustainability by the removal of toxics from our production systems and by the reliance on more nature-based fertility cycling. And hopefully it does serve as some kind of a model. The fact that it is polycultural and that we harvest something 52 weeks out of the year versus the farm across the street from me, which only harvests for a few days out of 365 days in a year, we're able to sponsor, you know, more than 60 full-time year-round jobs on our farm. That's when you factor in the temporary help that we use in the peak of the summer, it's actually one person per acre. The farm across the street from me is 640 acres, a square mile of just wine grapes, and it probably sponsors maybe 10 to 20 full-time year-round jobs on a farm almost 10 times the size of ours. So it's very unique in that respect. I think one of the things that we're afraid of, one of the things that, you know, if we demand 99-cent carrots, which Mark says we should have, if that's all we're going to pay for carrots, then you get the kind of carrots that Bolthouse and Grimway produces. Highly mechanized, highly chemicalized, except for their organic production, and both those companies produce organic carrots to their credit. And an approach to labor which kind of ignores the fact that that's the one resource that we're not short of on this planet is human beings. We got 7 billion of them, and I think we need to put them to work and eliminate some of these the toxic and the chemicalization of agriculture. We need more eyes and elbows per acre in order to care for soil better to hope to make agriculture sustainable.
Mark Bittman, what about mechanization? You talked about carrots moving at 50 miles an hour.
I think one of the interesting things here is to understand that there are a lot of different ways of doing things, and to see things as to see organic and conventional or industrial, whatever we want to call it, as polar opposites, I began to think was a mistake when I was out there. And I think, you know, there are a lot of ways of doing organic and there are a lot of ways of doing so-called conventional. I think it's interesting that Tom credits Bolthouse with having an organic operation, and I do also, but there's a huge, huge difference between the way Bolthouse does organic, which is on an industrial and almost conventional scale, except it presumably follows that letter of the organic law. There's a big difference between the way they do it and the way, as Tom was describing, he does it, which, you know, I also was really impressed by this sort of one worker per acre thing, which sets that kind of farming apart. And I think if we want to see conventional agriculture move in a sensible direction, we need to see it become more traditional. And by being more traditional, it means it's going to have to be more labor intensive. And again, as Tom says so correctly, that is one thing we do not have a shortage of.
What we run out of invariably is time on our programs, and we have come to that point. Mark Bittman, very quickly, you say at the end of your article that one of the things we ought to have is a national food and farming policy, but we don't. Do you see anything hopeful in that regard?
Not even close, no. Sorry.
Okay, well, we're going to have to end on that note. Mark Bittman, thanks to you. Tom Willey, thanks to you as well. And we'll be right back with Which Way LA.
Subscribe to the Which Way LA podcast at kcrw.com/WhichWayLA or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find Which Way LA on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on Which Way L.A. Proposition 32 on next month's ballot is generating big money and a deluge of campaign commercials. Here's one in favor of Proposition 32.
Money and politics. Corporations and unions give politicians millions in contributions. They get tax breaks and big pensions. We get higher taxes and wasteful spending. There's a better way. Proposition 32 prohibits deducting political contributions from employee paychecks without permission, bans corporate and union contributions to candidates, stops contractors from giving to politicians who approve their contracts. No loopholes, no exemptions. Vote yes on Proposition 32.
Who paid for that TV commercial? Here is Mike Mishak. He reports from Sacramento for the LA Times. Thanks for being on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What's the answer to that? Where's the money come from?
The two kind of main groups that are supporting Proposition 32 are anti-tax activists, business executives, and Republican donors. The main funder of a lot of the advertisements that Californians are seeing is actually the big Republican donor, Charles Munger Jr.
And Charles Munger Jr. is a big Republican donor. He inherited his wealth?
He is the son of Warren Buffett's business partner. He is also a Stanford physicist, and for many years has been a major GOP rainmaker and very big in Republican circles in California.
Okay, now here's a commercial against Proposition 32.
I'm Helen Hutchison, and I wanted you to know why the League of Women Voters opposes Proposition 32. Prop 32 is deliberately written to look like campaign reform, but it's not. It actually gives more power to Wall Street, big oil, and those secret campaign super PACs. And Prop 32 lets those same special interests spend unlimited and unregulated funds on politicians they support, while middle-class families pay the price. Learn more about Prop 32, because it's not what it seems.
Okay, back to Mike Mishak in Sacramento. Where does the money come for the anti-Proposition 32 campaign?
That money is coming from a labor-backed campaign. So essentially, labor unions have raised nearly $53 million so far to fight Proposition 32.
And which unions in particular?
The largest contributor to that has been the California Teachers Association. They haven't contributed quite half the $53 million, but it's pretty close, close to that. So the primary opponents funding that, the opposition campaign, would be the state's largest teachers union, and then also the Service Employees International Union.
Okay, and back to the pro 32 supporters, Charles Munger et al. How much have they contributed?
The various groups together, when you cobble them together, it looks like they've it's in the neighborhood of about $25 million.
Okay, so $25 million, $53 million, as one senator once said, pretty soon you're talking about big money.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is going to be the initiative that ultimately on both sides will draw the most amount of money, and probably Californians will end up seeing the most amount of advertisements for arguably the most complex ballot measure on the ballot in November.
Mike Mishak again, reporting from Sacramento for the LA Times. Bob Stern was president at the Center for Governmental Studies. He drafted California's Political Reform Act, which was adopted by 70% of the voters in 1974, a long time ago. Bob Stern, it's always good to have you on our program.
Warren, it's election season, my favorite time of the year.
Well, of course. Tell us about Proposition 32. You wouldn't really know from listening to those spots who was contributing to the pro or the anti campaigns.
Well, I actually think it's fairly straightforward. It bans contributions from corporations, bans contributions from labor unions, bans contributions from contractors to state and local campaigns. This is what the federal law does. It bans contributions from labor unions and corporations. But it does one more thing, and that's what they're fighting about. It says that labor unions and corporations can't use payroll deduction to take money from their employees or from the labor union members. And what labor says, this will completely unbalance the situation here in California and make it so that corporations and businesses dominate the political system. Unlike now, where they say it's about equal, in some cases I think labor unions dominate at the local level in school board elections and so forth. But labor unions are saying it would devastate their political impact in California.
And that's because they do deduct from payrolls, do they not, without asking their members?
No, they do ask their – well, the members can opt out. It's an opt-out as opposed to an opt-in. Under the proposal, you'd have to opt in every year and say, I want my money to go for political contributions. And so a small minority opts out now, and they're worried that a small minority would opt in if it were the other way around.
So it doesn't affect corporations the same way because they don't use money from payroll deductions for political campaigns.
Well, of course, in California right now, corporations can just make the contributions, so they don't have to do that. But at the federal level, they have to have PACs, political action committees, where they ask their employees, their shareholders, their officers to make contributions to the PACs, and they're very successful at doing that.
So let me go back to Mike Mishak in Sacramento. How's this doing in terms of the polls with all this money being spent and no doubt a lot more money to be spent before the election day?
Every major poll in California, including our last poll, which was a few weeks ago, shows it losing. And every poll also shows it with a significant amount of voters. In our poll, I think it was about 19% of voters were undecided on this. And I think a lot of that comes from the fact that voters are confused about what this initiative does. That was certainly borne out in many interviews I did with voters for a poll. They just didn't really comprehend it's a three-pronged initiative. And just also a clarification on what the initiative, I think Bob was saying that what the initiative would do is that would ask union members to get kind of their annual consent every year. That's what two previous initiatives that voters voted on in California would have done, and those failed. This initiative, the reason unions are so upset about it is that it would eliminate the mechanism of payroll deduction for all political contributions, even if union members wanted to opt in. If they wanted to give political contributions to their paychecks, they would be banned from doing so, and they'd have to write checks separately or kind of set up a direct deposit directly to their union if they were interested in contributing. So it's different than two previous initiatives, and has definitely the reason that labor is so opposed to it.
So, Bob Stern, you said this is pretty straightforward, and yet if you look at the official title and a summary, you have to read down an awful long way before you get to the kind of detail that both of you are talking about. And there's certainly nothing in the first five or six lines above the line that says analysis by the legislative analyst that says anything about having to opt in every year.
Well, the official ballot actually says the first sentence of prohibits unions from using payroll deducted funds for political purposes. So Mike is right. He's right about the payroll deductions, but a union member could contribute to the union just like the employees do.
But it's not very clear, it would seem to me, to a lay voter who goes into the ballot box or tries to read up on it ahead of time, as I say, until you get to the small print.
And the interesting thing, of course, Warren, is the official ballot title could have said bans corporations and labor unions from making contributions, but they say prohibits unions from using payroll-deducted funds. So they really hit the heart of the matter, which is the controversy here, which is the whole question, should unions be allowed to deduct money from their employees?
Why do you think, Bob, that the other two measures lost, and why does it appear, I gather it's behind, but again, I think the polls are shrinking a bit, the gap is shrinking a bit.
Well, as you know, Warren, only a third of initiatives pass, and any time there is major controversy on both sides, particularly on the no side, and where the no side spends lots of money, usually the initiative goes down. If the voters are confused, as they might be on this one, they're going to tend to vote no. And clearly the unions are relying on that. In the last two initiatives, the same thing happened. The unions consider this life or death. And so they're going to spend as much money as they can to defeat it.
Well, the corporations aren't doing bad with $25 million in so far. And, of course, there could be more. Now, does this apply just to state elections or also to those in cities and counties?
It applies to everything except federal races.
So it's pretty broad.
It's pretty broad. And of course, unions actually have a real impact at the local level, much more, as much as they do at the state level, because they have no opposition. Many cities, many school districts and so forth, it's only the unions who are making campaign contributions. So it'd have a big impact locally as well as at the state level.
Does it involve private as well as public unions? We heard that it was the California Teachers Association that has most of the money in the, or half the money in the no campaign.
It's all the unions.
All the unions. Okay, everything across the board. Mike Mishak, other states have had similar efforts on their ballots. So how have they done?
When you look at the kind of the similar states, other states have had similar efforts, whether they be either through laws passed by the legislature or initiatives. Right now, the law is some form of this, some form of a payroll deduction ban is kind of in effect for five states. It's kind of a mixed history when you look at, whether they have done what they promised to do, which is kind of curb the influence of special interests. In Washington State, actually, was the first state to pass something similar to this, and that was back in 1992. And that just would have asked union members whether or not it would ask them unions. It would have required unions to obtain their members' permission each year to use the dues for political purposes. And what unions were able to do in Washington State, and also to a certain extent in Michigan. Another union-heavy state, is that they've been able to kind of use legal challenges through the court system and be able to work with Democratic lawmakers to kind of water down and weaken the law. So in those two states, the unions, the measures haven't really been effective in curbing unions. In other states where unions are weaker, like Idaho and Utah, they have been very sort of crippling to labor there. They have in those two states that I mentioned, Idaho and Utah, it did something similar. It bans the use of payroll deduction for political contributions, and those unions report seeing their political coffers significantly depleted.
Okay, so this is part of something that is nationwide and now focused, of course, here in the biggest state in the union, California, Proposition 32. Michael Mishak with the LA Times, Bob Stern, formerly with the Center for Governmental Studies. Thank you both for being on our program.
Always a
Thanks
pleasure,
Warren.
You can find all our election coverage at kcrw.com/elections2012. In a moment, abortion rights, the U.S. Supreme Court, and the race for the White House on Which Way L.A. Warren Olney back with Which Way L.A. In last week's vice presidential debates, moderator Martha Raddatz asked Joe Biden and Paul Ryan about abortion. The vice president said his Catholic religion required him to oppose it in his own life.
Life begins at conception. That's the church's judgment. I accept it in my personal life. But I refuse to impose it on equally devout Christians and Muslims and Jews. And I just refuse to impose that on others, unlike my friend here, the congressman. I do not believe that that we have a right to tell other people that women, they can't control their body. It's a decision between them and their doctor.
The right to abortion was legalized in federal law by the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Roe v. Wade, and Roddatz asked Congressman Ryan, who's also Catholic, if supporters of that decision should fear a Romney administration.
We don't think that unelected judges should make this decision that people, through their elected representatives and reaching a consensus in society through the democratic process, should make this determination.
Erin Carmon is a staff writer at Salon.com. She's currently a visiting fellow at the Yale Law School's Study of Reproductive Justice. Good to have you on our program.
Nice to be back, Warren.
Has the Romney campaign and has the candidate for president himself made it clear that he does, in fact, support what we just heard from Congressman Ryan?
Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. Mitt Romney has taken so many different positions on abortion rights, but it's fairly constant that he thinks that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. At this point, basically, the constitutional right to abortion as recognized by the Supreme Court is being upheld by a 5-4 margin. It's very likely that the next president will appoint justices that will rule on abortion-related cases that may completely change the way that women access safe and legal abortions in this country.
When you say that he's taken different positions on abortion rights, what do you mean? When and where?
Well, I think I've heard different tallies between 9 and 14 times that Mitt Romney has changed his position on a woman's right to choose. Most recently, he said that he wasn't aware of any legislation that he was supporting, which is directly contradicted by an op-ed he wrote himself, saying that he would support legislation that was being voted for in Congress. So I think at this point, what he says that he believes is that he thinks abortion should be legal only in cases of rape, incest, and life endangerment. He would say life of the mother. And Paul Ryan believes that abortion should be banned absolutely, and that's the position of the Republican Party platform as well.
Ryan has said that he would support whatever Mitt Romney supports, and Romney has said that he would support abortion in the case where the mother's life was at risk.
That's true. That's currently his position, and that's probably because, I mean, frankly, Paul Ryan's position is more consistent, unless you believe there's such a thing as justifiable homicide if you've been raped. But at this point, I think rape exceptions, incest exceptions are very much supported by the American people, whereas the vast majority of Americans do not want to see abortion banned outright, even if they're ambivalent about it. So I think that Mitt Romney has chosen that position very carefully. That said, he certainly supports different legislation and also legal philosophies that would make it almost impossible for a woman to obtain an abortion.
Now, you said Mr. Romney had recently said, I think you told the Des Moines Register editorial board, that he doesn't know about any legislation in particular, but that he wrote, you say, an op-ed himself supporting a particular piece of legislation. When was that, and what did the legislation say?
So, of course, during the Republican primaries, there was a race to purity, both on women's access to contraception and women's access to safe and legal abortion. So he wrote an op-ed called My Pro-Life Pledge, explaining why he wasn't going to sign a very absolutist, quote-unquote, pro-life pledge. And so he said that he would support the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, which is the National Right to Life Committee's priority for the 112th Congress. And that is basically a ban on abortions at 20 weeks, which is a full month before viability without any exceptions. So again, that's specific legislation that if he were president and it came across his desk, he said he would sign. He also told Mike Huckabee that he would support a human life amendment during the Republican primaries, which is also understood to be an absolute ban on abortion and quite possibly on very popular forms of contraception.
Erin Carmon, again, at the Yale Law School's Study of Reproductive Justice and Salon.com. Janice Krauss is director and senior fellow of the Beverly LaHaye Institute, a think tank at Concerned Women for America. That's a conservative Christian policy advocacy group. Ms. Krauss, good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren. It's always great to be with you.
Do you agree that Mitt Romney has been inconsistent? And if not, what do you think he really believes?
I think he believes what he says right now. He's running for president, and he's made his position very, very clear. You know, actually, there are only a couple of positions that you can take on abortion, and it's really hilarious to talk about 15 changes of opinion and all of that. The truth of the matter is the position that the Republican Party holds is consistent with both of the major candidates, the president, the vice president, and the Republican platform. That position is strongly pro-life, which is consistent with the mainstream American values. It has, over the last few years, been shown that the majority of Americans want a sane, policy regarding abortion. We have erred to the point that abortion now is used primarily for birth control, and we see so many people who want absolutely no control over abortion, no restrictions whatsoever, abortion on demand that does not even inform parents or keep parents in the loop, who even go around parents and keep them in the dark regarding what's going on with their kids when they have to write a note for their child to take an aspirin at school. So we have gone so far overboard on the whole issue of abortion that we need some sanity, and most Americans recognize that, and most Americans and the mainstream of America is solidly pro-life. They want to have restrictions on abortion. They want to have some sanity returned to the whole issue.
You say that there are only a couple of positions that you can take. Ms. Carmon says that Mr. Romney has taken many positions. Were you concerned when he told the Des Moines Register that he didn't know of any particular piece of legislation that he might sign, when in fact he'd been supportive in the past of the legislation that she described?
I think the Republican Party is very clear that they are a constitutional party with the separation of powers. The executive branch, the president and the vice president, work through the legislature in any change of laws, in any kind of change of what is prevailing legal application. So, yes, the president would support legislation, but to say that there is legislation afoot right now is that's completely inaccurate. So his statement is, in my opinion, an accurate one. There's not legislation out there right now, and there is no legislation on the horizon. However, the president and the vice president and the whole Republican Party is strongly pro-life.
If there are only a couple of positions on abortion, what are they?
Pro-life and pro-abortion.
So that's it?
Yeah.
Irene Carmon, back to you. When you say 14 different times or 9 to 14 times he's changed positions, then what do you mean? How many positions are there as opposed to Janice Krauss saying there are only two, pro or con?
Well, Mitt Romney has been very creative in finding different ways. When he was the governor of Massachusetts, he said that he had become pro-choice in part because his cousin had died of an illegal abortion. And then he said eventually that he was pro-life for himself, but that he would not change the status quo on abortion. At various times, he supported exceptions and changed his mind on those exceptions. The other thing I would add about sort of mainstream American values is that I think the vast majority of Americans are united in the fact that if we want to see fewer abortions, we have to have better access to birth control and contraception. And one thing that Mitt Romney has been totally constant on is the fact that he completely opposes increased access to contraception, whether that's non-abortion related funding to Planned Parenthood or the fact that Obamacare has increased access to contraceptive care. So again, if we're talking about mainstream values, I think it's really important to note that the Romney-Ryan ticket is pretty opposed to increasing American women's access to birth control, which is the proven way to prevent abortions.
Okay, that's a different point. Let me get to it in a moment. But first, to Janice Krauss, what about the statement that, in fact, Mr. Romney has changed his position many times with regard to various exceptions, saying at one point that there wouldn't be any change, at another point that he did want to say a change. Doesn't that indicate that he has shifted around?
Well, so has Vice President Biden, who was strongly pro-life until he became part of the Obama administration. I think all of us have altered our views periodically on many very important issues. I don't begrudge that of Mr. Romney. He has the right opinion right now, in my opinion, and I am very pleased to see him take a strong stance now. And as president, he has made vocal statements that assure that he cannot back down. As president, he has taken a very positive stance that is pro-life. And when it comes to access to contraception, nobody who is a leader in the Republican Party at present time opposes contraception. This is something that's available on every street corner in America. Birth control is a fact of life in America, and nobody is saying we're going to cut that. The question is whether you're going to force people to supply that contraception. Will taxpayers be required to fund birth control, whether they believe in it or not? Individual people heretofore have had the right to their own conscientious objection. They have had the right to religious exceptions. And frankly, I think it's just ludicrous to think that there is anybody in America today who can't afford to pay for birth control, or if they cannot, that it's not available at community facilities all across this country. And, you know, I looked the other day online. You can buy birth control for something like $5 a month online.
I want to get to contraception in a moment, but first let me stick with abortion, a difficult enough issue in and of itself. Ann Stone is a political strategist and activist, and she is chair of Republicans for Choice. Ann Stone, good to have you back on our program.
Warren, thank you for having me.
Okay. What do you feel about Mitt Romney? And if you are Republicans for Choice, are you worried, given the language in the platform, given what Mr. Ryan said on the during the debate last week, that, in fact, there will be, if there's a Romney administration, a real effort to overturn or perhaps get the appoint justices who will overturn Roe versus Wade?
First of all, is it not amazing that 39 years after Roe, we're still talking about this? And I'll tell you, as I travel around the country and around the world, people are just absolutely blown away that this is still an issue. But it shows, through the discussion you've already had, what a personal and painful decision this is. And Romney's evolution, if there was one on this issue, reflects what a lot of people, as Janice said, go through. They evolve as they get more information, and I believe some of the misinformation Romney's been given can help correct and bring him back to closer to what his position had been, and that is that personally he may be pro-life, but legislatively he understands we don't want to turn back Roe, we don't want to return to back alley abortion, and his family certainly, as was alluded to, has a personal experience with having a cousin die at age 21 of a back alley abortion, something that, in fact, many people who are opponents of abortion claim is a fantasy, that those things didn't happen. Romney knows it isn't a fantasy. He knows that personally. So do I worry about the direction he'd take the party in? No. I think what he said in Iowa is really closer to what he's talking about, and that is he's not going to make it a priority. It's not going to be one of the things he pushes on. I think he's going to take the Mitch Daniels approach that social issues have to be set aside. We've got to get this economy straight. We have to be working together. Abortion is an issue that divides us. We need to look at what we agree on right now, and we need to fix the country first.
So you're saying, as I understand it then, that he doesn't agree with the platform, which says this should be the province of elected representatives, and that he doesn't agree with his vice president, but that he still has been given misinformation, and he kind of has to be straightened out on it.
Yeah, there's a lot of misinformation, as we saw through the Todd Akin comments, that's floating around out there, and people need a better education with real science to understand the real issues that we're confronting. But both of your previous speakers touched on something that is true, and that is Americans do want to see abortion discouraged. They want to see less of it. How we get there is where we need to come together, finding common ground, and most of it is through better contraception and better contraceptive education, et cetera. Because people do want to see abortion discouraged. There's a paradox. People want women to have the right to control their own bodies and control their reproductive decisions, but they do want to see less abortion. So this new president could find a way, perhaps, after he's gotten the economy a little bit more stable, to find a way to bring people together to try to find real common ground solutions to this issue, and maybe we can have some sanity.
Janice Krauss, back to you. Do you agree that he will back off, or that he will stay with what his current position and what the platform says, which is that this should not be a matter for the courts, but rather for legislatures?
I think he'll stick with it being a matter for legislators. That's the constitutional position, and he has sworn to uphold the Constitution, and he has made promises to pro-life people. He's taking a very strong pro-life stance.
John Gramlich is legal affairs reporter at Congressional Quarterly, and John, it's good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
We know that Roe versus Wade was decided by the U.S. Supreme Court, so what comes up next is the presidential appointment power. Why is that so important right now, especially for the term of the next person elected to be in the White House?
Yeah, this is sort of a dog that didn't bark on the presidential campaign trail, as it were. I remember in June and in the months leading up to the Supreme Court's health care decision, which came at the very end of June, pretty much everyone thought that this was going to be a major point of debate between the candidates, and it seemed as if President Obama was already on the way to running against the Supreme Court in expectation that it would overturn the health care ruling, the health care overhaul, I should say. And then the ruling came down, and of course it went in his favor. And since then, the Supreme Court has really gone away and hasn't come back up until this vice presidential debate just a few days ago. So it is a very important issue. There could be one or two vacancies in the court next term. Ruth Bader Ginsburg would be 83 by the time the next presidential term expires, and both Justice Kennedy and Justice Scalia would be 80 years old. So it's really likely that there will be at least one.
And Ruth Bader Ginsburg has suffered from pancreatic cancer, a very serious illness.
Right. Right. And she's pretty much said that she intends to retire at the end of the next presidential term or when she's about 82 or 83.
And let me go to Ann Stone. You're with Republicans for a Choice. Are you concerned that if Mr. Romney were elected, he would nominate a justice that would be in favor of overturning Roe versus Wade?
We are concerned, but I think you saw a surprise on the Obamacare ruling, and I think you'd find a surprise if it ever came back to an actual vote on Roe. I don't think the conservatives have the votes they think they have, and it would, of course, depend on who is retiring, because if he appointed somebody to replace Scalia, it wouldn't matter. It would be a wash. Obviously, if it's Ginsburg or Stephen or Kennedy, that would be problematic. But again, I take him at his word that, from the way the current platform is worded, it simply says support judges who believe in the sanctity of life. That's way different than previous platforms, much more mealy-mouthed, although Romney has said that he did not endorse the platform, the remarks to the contrary otherwise. He's running on his own platform, not on the party's platform. But, there is some concern, and it's going to be a matter of who comes in his administration around him and the kind of advice he has. But I do know his family's not for the overturn of Roe, and hopefully they're going to have some influence on him.
John Gramlich, the president appoints a lot of justices other than those at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Sure, this is a huge issue. I mean, beyond the Supreme Court, there are 13 United States Courts of Appeals that decide a huge number of cases that never make it to the Supreme Court, and then there are 94 federal trial courts as well, and all of these are appointed by the president, and all of them are lifetime appointments that need to be confirmed by the Senate. So this is a huge issue here in Washington, and something that is extremely partisan inside the Capitol building, but doesn't seem to really resonate on the campaign trail. I mean, we haven't even seen the Supreme Court being discussed really by either of the candidates. Neither of them has mentioned it regularly. Neither of them mentioned it in their acceptance speeches at the convention. And that's you're talking about the highest court in the land, let alone these lower courts that have the final say on most legal questions.
Janice Krause, back to you at the Beverly LaHaye Institute, the Christian Policy Advocacy Group, Concerned Women for America. Would you want to hold Mr. Romney's feet to the fire on the issue of appointing a justice to the Supreme Court who was likely to be opposed to Roe versus Wade and might vote to overturn it should the issue come up?
We don't focus on overturning Roe v. Wade, and I think that's really a red herring. When the economy is in the state it's in today, I don't think there are many people who would go out on a limb and say overturn Roe v. Wade. We definitely want someone who is pro-life, and that is something that future President Romney would support.
That's all the time we have for Which Way LA. Thanks very much to all of our guests. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Evan George, Sonia Geis, and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. You can visit the Which Way LA blog for more stories about Southern California at kcrw.com/whichwayla blog. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation.